From New York to Kansas, Illinois to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a new poll conducted by American Commitment finds seniors are more concerned with health insurance-related costs than with healthcare affordability itself. Phil Kirpin is here with details. Andy Roth from the State Freedom Caucus Network has the real story on how taxpayer-funded university health systems in Pennsylvania are performing gender reassignment surgery on underage children. The recently passed debt ceiling bill is likely to force more, not fewer, Americans onto welfare. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine joins us with details. And the Russian people have historically suffered from a culture of death. Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine has added to those woes. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. As part of its commitment to seniors, the Washington, D.C.-based public policy group American Commitment recently conducted a poll of those over the age of 55 to discern their views on a wide range of healthcare-related issues. Here to discuss the poll's results is American Commitment President Phil Kirpin. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, American Commitment has its commitment to seniors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is a project that we launched a couple of years ago because we keep losing these policy debates in Washington on healthcare where AARP comes in as the 800-pound gorilla, and they advocate things that are sort of contrary to kind of the free market kind of approach to healthcare reform that we favor. And of course, they were a huge player in Obamacare, and they've been a huge player in the policy debate since. And so we're trying to counter their influence by exposing the way they operate and the way their finances are tied to United Health and the way they support Democrats almost exclusively. And so for 3 or 4 years now, we've had Chris Jacobs at Juniper Research do a report on their financials, and we're trying to recondition the way politicians hear advocacy messages coming from AARP as not this is what seniors think, but instead kind of, okay, this is what United Health and the insurance industry and liberal Democrats that work with AARP think.
As part of that effort, you recently conducted a poll, a survey, a significant survey. Tell us a little bit about the poll, who conducted it, what was the methodology, and what were the issue areas, and then we'll go into some of the findings.
We worked with McLaughlin and Associates on this, so a major national pollster, the same pollster that President Trump used. And the idea behind the poll was to find out what seniors think about AARP's behavior and some of the recent policy debates, especially around last year's so-called Inflation Reduction Act, but to have a big enough poll sample so we wouldn't just be able to get numbers on what seniors think, but also what AARP members specifically think about the things that AARP's been doing. And so, you know, that was the theory behind the poll, and it was a pretty big undertaking, and we got a very, very big slide deck of data back from it that, you know, we've been talking about in media like this and on Capitol Hill and so forth.
Let's talk first, Phil, about healthcare affordability. For those 55-plus, healthcare issues, particularly affordability, is a major life concern. As you look at the results of this poll, what were the most concerning aspects of healthcare to those 55 and older?
Well, the top concerns in our poll were actually the same top concerns as AARP's own poll, and those were insurance-related costs, things like in copays and deductibles and premiums, as opposed to long-term care costs or prescription drug costs, which is interesting because it's kind of the opposite of sort of the assumption that's been embedded in a lot of the policy debates in Washington over the last couple of years, which have been all about drug costs all the time. We found that the cost of drugs was a relatively low priority among seniors compared to those other insurance-related costs. And also kind of in that battery of questions, we found out that about 85% of seniors think that any savings from changes to Medicare should stay inside the Medicare program rather than being rated out for unrelated spending, which is something the Democrats did in their bill last year. We also found that seniors think that any changes to drug pricing, the lower prices, should be passed only to seniors. They shouldn't be diverted by insurance companies or pharmacy middlemen. We also found out that there are very high concerns that price controls will cause less innovation, less treatment, less cures, which is not really present in the debate last year at all. And maybe the most interesting finding, kind of on the health costs and concerns about area questions, is a very small percentage, only about 20% of seniors, think they'll actually get lower drug costs from what Congress did last year, despite, you know, all the Democrats and the AARP touting that as a huge victory.
It's interesting, and I did not know this before reading your brief on the poll here, Phil, that some of the money from Medicare drug savings was diverted to electric vehicle tax credits. Why is money being diverted into unrelated items like that?
This was the structure of the bill they did last year, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which should probably have been Inflation Acceleration Act, because the original CBO score of, you know, all those green giveaways has already doubled. And so, you know, originally they said, you know, that this bill took about $300 billion out of Medicare. It had $200 or $300 billion in higher taxes, including the supersizing of the IRS, which was supposed to bring in all this money. And then it spent the money basically on two major buckets of spending. One was the, you know, the supersized subsidies in Obamacare, and the other, you know, biggest bucket was all these green giveaways and the electric vehicles and the wind and solar and, you know, all of the various advanced hydrogen, this, that, and the other thing. Just the massive amounts of green spending that was in that bill was really where most of the money was spent. And then they said that there was also going to be a little bit of deficit reduction, and they said that's how it's going to reduce inflation. Of course, the cost of the green energy giveaways has more than doubled already in a year, and so now there's no savings to the Treasury at all. Every dollar that they get out of their pay-fors goes to the green energy giveaways, and so and then some. It actually increases the deficit pretty substantially at this point. And so if your major source of funding in the bill is cuts to Medicare drug spending, and the major spending areas are the green energy stuff, I don't think there's really any other way to see it except that they're taking money out of Medicare drug spending and they're handing it over to, you know, the green energy groups in these various giveaways, even though they never characterized or explained the bill that way. I mean, that's the major source of funds, and that's the major destination for them in what they passed last year.
Another key segment of the poll that American Commitment conducted here, Phil, focused on AARP and their financial relationships. And this is very disturbing. Their relationship with something called United Healthcare. Would you tell us a bit about that relationship, and what did the poll show that seniors felt about this?
United Health is the largest healthcare company in this country. It's one of the largest companies, period. It's actually larger than the largest bank. It's a bigger company than J.P. Morgan at this point, and I think it employs something like 8 or 10% of all of the doctors in this country. So, I mean, it's just become a massive, massive entity, and it's also by far the number one source of funding for AARP, because one of the big product lines that United sells is they have various AARP-branded Medicare plans, Medicare prescription drug plans, Medicare Advantage plans, Medigap supplemental plans. And the way this deal is structured, any United plan that has the AARP brand on it, they skim 5% of every premium every month forever off the top. And when you tell seniors, when you ask them, are you concerned that the majority of AARP's revenue comes from corporate royalty arrangements, mostly with United Healthcare, 85% of them say they are concerned. 90% say they're concerned that they're lobbying on changes to Medicare at the same time they're making most of their money from the largest health insurance company.
One of the statistics in a poll conducted by American Commitment on health affordability concerns and AARP advocacy activities. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment. If folks would like to go online to read results of this poll also, where can they go to do that?
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to focus on kind of the big fight at any given point in time. If people want to see any of our research, it's on our website at americancommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, always good to have you back with us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Loman.
We would like to welcome back an old friend, Andy Roth, who for many years was with the Club for Growth, and we heard him weekly here on American Radio Journal. He is now president of the State Freedom Caucus Network. More on that a little bit later, but we're going to talk about some of the key issues in states around the country. Andy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Loman. It feels like old times.
It surely does. So great to have you with us, and it's also good to talk about the outstanding work that is being done by the State Freedom Caucus Network and the Freedom Caucuses in various states around the country. We're going to start out, Andy, with some activity in my home state, Pennsylvania. We all know that educational institutions lean to the left, but Pitt, Penn State, and Temple, three state-related universities in Pennsylvania, seem to be outdoing themselves these days. What's up with those three institutions?
The organization that I run, the State Freedom Caucus Network, our job is to help create and then assist state freedom caucuses. And we've got 11 of them across the country, and one of them is the Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus. And they are made up of about 20 state lawmakers in the Pennsylvania legislature in Harrisburg. And our job at the network is just to help them operate similar to how the House Freedom Caucus works in Congress. And recently, it came to the Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus's attention that Penn State, Temple, and Pitt were all, their medical systems, their hospitals, were providing transgender surgeries and services to minors. And so the Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus put out a statement demanding records and information from all three of these schools about what's going on. They were given a June 2nd deadline to submit everything that the Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus requested. And when that date came and went, they did receive information from the schools, but we were told that basically, yes, they were doing all this stuff. And so the fight has now become engaged where they are going to have to answer to the legislature why they deserve funding, not just for this transgender services they provide, but why they should deserve any money at all from the state, because these schools receive tax dollars from people in the state. And it requires a two-thirds vote from the legislature in order for them to receive funding. So we've got them on their heels trying to defend this garbage, and the Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus is leading that charge. They're the ones that are saying, you got to cut this stuff out. You got a clean shot, because what you're doing is chemical castration and child mutilation. And so that fight is currently ongoing, and it's going to get very public very quickly as they debate the budget. So it's a very serious fight, but thankfully we have a Freedom Caucus in Pennsylvania, and they're the ones that are leading the charge.
It gets even worse than that, Andy. News broke this past week. The University of Pittsburgh, by the way, has gone completely off the rails on all of this stuff. There's been some issue relative to research on fetuses and abortion. But the news broke this past week, Andy, where a couple of months ago, there was a debate scheduled, not a speech, but a debate scheduled on transgendered issues, and left-wing activist groups literally rioted in the streets of Oakland, which is part of Pittsburgh. They set off an incendiary device. The police had to be called in. Well, now the University of Pittsburgh is attempting to charge the conservative groups for the security response to the near riot that occurred by the left, which is really interesting. That rather than charge the rioters, they want to charge the people who are only there for a debate, theoretically what colleges are supposed to do. Well, you did mention, Andy, that the State Freedom Caucus Network has a number of states around the country. So let's talk about a couple of other states where there has been considerable action. That's action in all of them, but a couple of note here. The state of Wyoming, we don't get to talk about Wyoming too often. So what has the State Freedom Caucus Network in Wyoming been up to?
Overall, this is kind of the problem that we're trying to address, is that there are 50 swamps in the 50 states, and they are arguably, actually definitively, in my opinion, swampier than D.C., if that's, that may be hard to believe, but it's true. In Wyoming, for example, there are 57 Republicans to only 5 Democrats in the Wyoming House. So you would think that they would be passing all kinds of strong conservative policies similar to what we're seeing in Florida, but they're not. And the reason why is that when you look at the actual voting records of the members of the Wyoming House, instead of it being 57-5, it's 36 liberals to 26 conservatives. And you might be asking why that is. Well, in Wyoming, it's such a red state. In fact, It voted for Trump more than any other state in the union in 2020. But that's precisely the problem, ironically, is because all the liberals in Wyoming know that they cannot get elected to office with a D after their name. So instead, they just put an R after their name and then behave like liberals once they're elected. And so our Wyoming Freedom Caucus is, you would think, would have an easy job in a state like Wyoming. But because of that problem, that's what they're confronted with. Now, the good news is the Wyoming Freedom Caucus was able to stop film subsidies to Hollywood. They were able to shut down Medicaid expansion. But they lost on key issues like school choice, because all of these liberal Republicans are in the pocket of the teachers union. So that's sort of the battle that we're facing, and it's something that we're trying to draw a lot of attention to, because every red state is like this, except for maybe Florida. Texas is a problem. Tennessee is a problem. Alabama, like all of the red states, are plagued by Democrats who are masquerading as Republicans. That's the fight we're having in Wyoming, and it's something that we're addressing on a daily basis.
Andy Roth, president of the State Freedom Caucus Network. Andy, if we have listeners who would like to learn more about your organization and then go out and see what's happening in the individual states, where would they go to get that information?
They can go to statefreedomcaucus.org, and on there they can see the map of where all of our State Freedom Caucuses are. If you see your state that has a Freedom Caucus, please reach out to them and see how you can help. If you don't see a Freedom Caucus in your state, please reach out to us to see how you can set one up.
Andy Roth of the State Freedom Caucus Network. Andy, good to have you back with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Loman. Take care.
More Americans will be forced onto welfare as a result of the recently enacted debt limit bill. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
One of the more fascinating sideshows during the whole debate over raising the federal government's debt ceiling was the Republican-led effort to impose new work requirements on some food stamp recipients, specifically on working-age, able-bodied, childless adults between the ages of 50 and 54. And regardless of where you lie on the right side of the political spectrum, from libertarian all the way over to the far right, this is something that you probably can agree with, at least in broad strokes. The fact that people who are of working age, who are not handicapped, who don't have children, that they should have to at least put forth the effort of finding a job before qualifying for federal welfare benefits. But in the end, however, the debt ceiling deal that was struck between Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy and President Joe Biden is likely to end up with more Americans qualifying for food stamps, not less, and many of them being people under age 50 who will no longer be subject to those same work requirements. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a look at this one particular sort of niche issue within the debt ceiling deal, the new work requirements for food stamp qualification that will target individuals over age 50, some individuals over age 50. But the thing you heard a lot less about is the fact that the debt ceiling deal also loosens, and in some cases significantly loosens, the existing work requirements for people under age 50. Now, on the left, again, the idea that able-bodied, working-age, childless food stamp beneficiaries should be required to find employment in order to qualify for government benefits was met with the sort of usual shrill responses that you hear anytime Republicans try to impose any sort of limitation on welfare. Claims that Republicans must hate the poor, stuff like that. On the right, however, the focus about this new work requirement was really on making sure that government welfare systems aren't sending the wrong signals. All the way back in April, when he announced the framework for this debt ceiling deal, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said that incentives matter, and the incentives today are out of whack. He said he wanted to get Americans back to work. I think that's a noble goal. But again, it's a goal that the debt ceiling deal ultimately falls short of. Under the terms of the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023, that's the technical name for the debt ceiling deal, which of course got through Congress and made it to President Joe Biden's desk just before the planned default on June 5th. It looks like an estimated 78,000 additional people will gain access to food stamps. That number comes to us from the Congressional Budget Office and specifically from an analysis that the CBO did of the deal just a few days before it was passed. Those additional beneficiaries will add an estimated $2.1 billion to the cost of the food stamp program. Technically, that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's $2.1 billion over the course of the next decade is not a small amount of money, but ultimately a minuscule increase to a program that costs over $120 billion a year. So the number of new enrollees and the additional costs here are interesting, but not all that significant. What's more interesting is how the food stamp enrollment numbers will increase at all, given all the political rhetoric that we heard on both sides. I mean, again, the left was saying that Republicans were trying to kick people off of welfare, and the right was arguing that getting people off of welfare by getting them into jobs was the goal here. So why does this deal actually put more people on welfare? Much of the media coverage about it was focused on how the Republican plan to apply work requirements, again, for able-bodied, childless adults between the ages of 50 and 54. Those between the ages of 50 and 52 will face the new work requirements immediately this October, and then the limit will be raised next year up to 54. Individuals under age 50 are already subject to these work requirements. Again, able-bodied, childless individuals under age 50. But the media coverage of this has really only told half the story, because the bill will also remove work requirements for many people across all age groups. According to the CBO, several groups would be newly exempt from work requirements, including people experiencing homelessness, veterans, and people ages 18 to 24 who were in foster care when they turned 18. The expanded work requirements for those over 50 will ultimately save about $6.5 billion in the next decade, according to the CBO, but the new exclusions, these new loopholes that are written into the law, will more than offset those savings because it will cost the program $6.8 billion over the same period. Again, the dollars aren't really the most important part here. As a result of the changes made in the debt ceiling bill, what we end up with is the fact that some 50-somethings will now be required to work to receive food stamps, but some, say, 30-somethings, 20-somethings, will be able to access food stamps while remaining jobless. And it's unclear how that trade-off is supposed to correct what McCarthy, I think, correctly identified as the out-of-whack incentives in the federal welfare system. Since the changes will add beneficiaries to the SNAP program, to the food stamp program, they will do nothing to address the worrying growth in the cost of that program, which has actually doubled since 2019. It's also unclear to me why these new distinctions should have been added to the law at all. I mean, okay, maybe excluding the homeless might make some sense, but why shouldn't able-bodied and childless veterans, a group of people who already have a plethora of exclusive job opportunities available to them, be expected to find work before getting SNAP benefits, before getting food stamps? And maybe even a better question is, why should someone's living situation as an 18-year-old being in foster care affect whether they qualify for an unrelated welfare program years later? Each new protected class of individuals who are exempt from the rules undermines the goal of transitioning able-bodied Americans from welfare to work. That's likely to increase both dependence on the welfare system and resentment of what seem like pretty arbitrary lines to dole out different benefits to different people of otherwise equal socioeconomic status. If anything, the deal seems to worsen the already bizarre incentives at play in the welfare system, not make them any better. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. You can check out more of our coverage of everything that was in the debt ceiling deal and everything going on in Washington and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The war in Ukraine continues a historic pattern of Russians suffering catastrophic loss of life during times of conflict. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
I feel only sympathy for the Russians. No people have suffered as much death. So said Jan Vinyetsky, a Polish professor and former advisor to the Solidarity Movement in the 1980s. I had hosted Jan as a guest lecturer in one of my courses at Grove City College. He spoke about the Polish people suffering under the jackboot of Soviet communism. The ongoing assault upon his Polish people by the beast to the east had gone on for a long time. In fact, well before the post-World War II Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe. Stalin's Soviet Union in August 1939 had struck a deal with Hitler that saw both the Soviets and the Nazis invading Poland in September 1939 and jointly co-launching World War II. So I asked Jan, do you hate the Russians because of all this? Jan's response, oh no, No. I feel only sympathy for the Russians. No people have suffered as much death. Jan is right. Go back to World War I. The Russians lost more men in combat than any nation in World War I. And though they had allied with the winning side, the Bolsheviks pulled them out in October 1917, meaning they tasted no fruits of victory. Instead, the Russian people got a Russian civil war from 1918 to 21 that left over 7 million Russian men, women, and children dead. The Russian people's reward for that period of suffering? Guess what? 70 years of Bolshevism, which meant death, death, and more death. The Red Terror of Lenin, the Great Purge of Stalin, and more. The internal purges were interrupted only and horrifically by World War II, where the Russians slash Soviets once again lost more men than any other country in the conflict by far. In fact, historians are still trying to figure out how many Russian Soviets were killed in World War II, but the figure is likely 20 to 30 million. It might be as high as 40 times the combined World War II deaths of the United States and the United Kingdom. Think about that. And how many people perished under Marxism-Leninism in the USSR? Again, no one knows for sure. The Harvard University Press book, The Black Book of Communism, says only 20 million. Other authorities go higher. Alexander Yakovlev, in his 2002 Yale University press work, A Century of Violence in Soviet Russia, claims that Joseph Stalin alone annihilated 60 to 70 million people. Alexander Solzhenitsyn uses similar numbers. And yet none of these figures include also the uniquely horrific and unprecedented number of abortions in the country. Yes, Lenin and his minions immediately legalized abortion as soon as they seized control of the Kremlin in 1920. By the 1970s, according to official Soviet Health Ministry statistics, the Soviet Union was averaging an unbelievable 7 to 8 million abortions per year, dwarfing American numbers in the worst throes of Roe v. Wade. History has never seen anything like it, potentially close to 80 million abortions in the 1970s alone. Death, death, death. I mention this now because of new figures regarding Russia's perpetual culture of death, namely the staggering losses by Russia in Vladimir Putin's war against the Ukraine. Some current estimates are that Putin's Russia may have experienced 250,000 casualties in the Ukraine. That is devastating. For a sense of comparison, America lost about 55,000 men in Vietnam over a decade plus of combat. So the Russians have lost multiple times what we lost in Vietnam in a year in Ukraine, courtesy of a madman, Vladimir Putin, who has mercilessly fed hundreds of thousands of Russian boys into a meat grinder in a war that those boys don't want. And now there are new numbers showing that the long-term demographic crisis in Russia is worsening, as few people are having children, fewer are emigrating there, and huge numbers are leaving, especially young boys who don't want to be forcibly conscripted into Putin's war. They're getting out of Dodge rather than being sacrificed to Putin's bloodlust for Ukraine. Tragically, the Russian people remain mired in a perpetual culture of death. Mad Dog Putin is merely making things worse. Few people have suffered so much. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WXRQ-FM in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, WSSH-FM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with KCLC-FM in St. Charles, Missouri. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.